as Jonathan Edwards lay dying, the great theologian's final words took on a deeply personal and affectionate tone. Give my kindest love to my dear wife, and tell her that the uncommon union which has so long subsisted between us has been of such a nature as I trust is spiritual and therefore will continue forever. I love that. He referred to the relationship with his beloved Sarah as that uncommon union. The Bible tells us that two people in marriage mysteriously become one flesh. In the words of Edwards, they form an uncommon union. A one flesh kind of union that excludes everybody else, including parents and children. A union that achieves its greatest glory by serving as a pattern for a greater union that is even more uncommon. The most stunning truth that is ever declared at a Christian wedding is that the uncommon union of a man and a woman serve to image the eternal union that exists between God and the people who are intimately His. A union that will finally, fully exclude all others. Of course, as you well know, friends, the place it's developed most openly is in Ephesians 5. Husbands, wives, Christ, and the church. This is a great mystery, Paul says, regarding the uncommon union of a man and a woman. But he immediately turns the corner and says, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. Now, by mystery, what he means is not something mysterious. Rather, it refers to something that has been there all along in the patterns of the Old Testament, but hidden in the shadows so as not to be fully perceived. With the coming of Jesus Christ, however, all such mysteries are unveiled in full disclosure. So that now, when two people enter into Christian marriage, they are meant to exemplify something about the relationship between Christ and the church. And conversely, the relationship between Christ and the church is meant to be a kind of archetype of what a marriage ought to be in certain respects. In fact, beloved, the deepest degree of climactic intimacy human beings can know, sexual union in a good marriage, is the very symbolism God dares to use to help us to understand something of the intimacy we will experience with Him in the new creation. It's the very imagery implied by Paul when he says to the Corinthian Christians, I want to present you to Christ as a pure virgin. It's the reason compromises with idolatry among the Thyatiran Christians can be referred to as adultery. It's why in the vision of Revelation 14, authentic Christians are referred to as those who have kept their virginity. The church of Jesus Christ is nothing less than His betrothed bride. And the point is, you see, a day of consummation is coming. The marriage supper of the Lamb, the ultimate expression of intimacy in this most uncommon union. And on that day, precisely because of what Jesus Christ has done for her, the church will stand alongside Him as His bride in unsullied splendor and unspeakable glory. It will be nothing less than the total transformation of the ugliest duckling into the most beautiful swan. The ultimate Cinderella story. It is the scene now set before us in Revelation 21. And why should this in any way be of importance to you? It's because, my friends, you're looking into a mirror when you read these verses. If you belong to the Church of Jesus Christ, you are seeing here a reflection of yourself. A portrait of what we together will one day be. In this passage, we're not merely the spectators this morning. We ourselves are the spectacle. The new creation here, as it expresses itself in the people who enjoy an uncommon union with God for eternity. Now, you may recall that to help us understand this entire scene, we've subdivided it into four smaller sections. And we've labeled them as follows. That which is new, verses 1 through 8. That which is symbolic, verses 9 through 21. That which is missing, verses 22 to 27. And finally, that which is central, chapter 22, verses 1 to 5. For this morning, then, we turn our attention to the second of these subdivisions, that which is symbolic. Now, I've given it this label, friends, because of the four subdivisions that complete this vision, this section is the most graphically symbolic. Marva Dawn says, this here is the description of a poet gone crazy with delight. It is the recapitulation of the theme that was first introduced back in verse 2. Remember this? I also saw, John writes, the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared like a bride adorned for her husband. But this was not the initial thing John was given to see in this vision. Look at verse 1. Before he ever mentions seeing the holy city, he says, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. Now, for discussion's sake, skip over verse 2 for a second. I saw a new heaven, I saw a new earth. What does John then do in verses 3 through 8? He returns to illustrate the glorious features that will define what he saw first in this vision, the new heaven and the new earth. You say, well, Art, what about the holy city he mentioned back in verse 2? This, now beginning in verse 9, is the thing that becomes his burden to explain. In other words, friends, he moves from the new heaven and new earth to the holy city. And we will see it this morning unfold under four headings. The city identified, the city described, the city measured, and the city evaluated. Firstly, the city identified. Verse 9. Then one of the seven angels who had held the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came and spoke with me. Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. He then carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem. Now, my friends, lest there be any confusion in your mind, physically speaking, you need to appreciate the fact that the Apostle John is still on the island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea. But in a state of prophetic inspiration, that is, in the realm of the Spirit and by the means of the Spirit, he is taken to a great and high mountain to witness the next scene in this vision, in particular, the holy city. But that begs a question that we intentionally left lingering a couple of weeks ago. What is this city? How are we to identify it? Well, let me ask you a second question, friends. What's the point at the outset of this, in verse 9, what's the point of mentioning this angel who had held one of the seven bowls of judgment? John mentions that because he hopes that it triggers something in your mind. The last time he used this very phrase. Keep your finger here and turn back to chapter 17. Do you remember this? Chapter 17, verse 1. John begins a new vision. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me. Come, I will show you the judgment of the whore, the harlot, the notorious prostitute who sits on many waters. Now, back here in chapter 21, verse 9, John uses precisely the same language all over again. But why does he do this? Well, 21 chapters into this business, maybe he's running out of creative ways to introduce visions? No, my friends, his intention literarily is obvious. It's to set these two cities against one another, both of which, I would remind you, are referred to as women. Babylon in chapter 17, the harlot. New Jerusalem, the bride. Now, I draw this parallel, my friends, to your attention precisely because recognizing it will help you with the identification of this city. Its counterpart, back in chapter 17, Babylon. And what did we discover? That it's not a literal city. It is the personification of human culture in antagonism to God. The community of the entire human race as it exists in its socio-economic and religious idolatry, likened there, if you recall, to a whore. Here then is her holy counterpart, her opposite number, as it were, the New Jerusalem, the holy city. But again, beloved, not a literal city. It's the counterpart to Babylon. It is the personification of a community of human beings who have been radically faithful to God. Referred to as a bride. Referred to as the wife of the Lamb. The wife of the Lamb. The wife of the Lamb. I don't think it can be any simpler. It is a reference to the church. But why does John here liken the church to a city? Well, my friends, the fact of the matter is the New Testament is filled with many metaphors with regard to the church. And each of these metaphors illustrate a certain component that is indicative of the relationship the church shares with Jesus Christ. Sometimes the Bible refers to the church as a body, but the church isn't a literal body. And sometimes the Bible refers to the church as a flock of sheep, but we're not a literal flock of sheep. And sometimes the Bible speaks of the church as a temple, as a family, as branches on a vine. But we're not to assume that all of these are to be understood literally. Here, in this context, the church is likened to a city. But why? For the same reason that fallen humanity back in chapter 17 was referred to as a city, it makes clear that what is in view is a community of human beings. In the ancient Middle East, my friends, a city was regarded as the ultimate expression of community. Why then refer to the church as a bride? To stress the fact that here, on her wedding day, she appears in the pinnacle of her beauty. Why refer to the church as a wife? To convey the unique intimacy she shares with the Lamb. The new heaven and new earth, it's a place for a people. The New Jerusalem, it's a people for a place. The new heaven and new earth, it's the home that God has prepared for His bride. The New Jerusalem, it's the bride that God has prepared for her home. The identification of this city, the identification of this bride, this wife, it is the church triumphant. That is, all of the people of God from all of the ages of redemptive history here seen in the fulfillment of what was promised in Ephesians chapter 5. In the fullness of her perfected beauty, without spot, without wrinkle, or any such thing, but holy and blameless. It's the city identified. Secondly, consider, if you will, the city described. In the Greek text, verses 10 through 14 comprise one compound sentence made up of five smaller phrases that describe this city. Notice the first of these. He showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. It's the very phrase that we considered back in verse 2. That she is descending out of heaven speaks of the origin of this perfected church. That she is descending from God speaks of the originator of this perfected church. He sees the church in all of her glory and beauty, coming down out of heaven from God. What's the point? It's quite simple. It's that this perfected church, in all of her radiance and all of her spotless splendor, is not the achievement of human beings, but of God Himself. Notice the second descriptive phrase, verse 11. Having God's glory, or arrayed with God's glory. Her radiance was like a very precious stone, like a jasper stone, bright as crystal. Now, beloved, this is not the first time that we've come across this kind of description. Back in chapter 4, do you remember that? When John is invited into heaven's throne room, and he sees the radiance of this God who dwells in unapproachable light, he likens what he sees to the shimmering radiance of a costly jasper. Now here, that same dazzling radiance is seen to be emanating now from the church. Why? Because, as he tells us, the church is arrayed with the glory of God. The church is clothed with the glory of God. We were told back at the end of verse 2 that this church coming down out of heaven from God has been prepared like a bride adorned for her husband. Adorned with what? Adorned with the glory of God. His glory being a signal manifestation of His presence. When God's glory is there, God is there. You see, beloved, these two chapters are a fulfillment of a great prophecy that occurs in the last 8 chapters of the book of Ezekiel. The prophecy of a final temple in which God will forever place His glory. The fact is, the language and imagery in these two chapters are drawn from that great text in the Old Testament. And do you know by chance, have you read it recently? Do you know by chance how it all ends in Ezekiel? The very last line of the book with this one final phrase: Yahweh is there. The glory of God is there. Ezekiel sees it. In that last day's temple that radiates the glory of God, Yahweh Himself is there. And that, you see, is what this is. The Lord is here. His very presence manifested by the radiance of His unshielded glory. Only here, my friends, you see what John does is John reinterprets Ezekiel. He pushes Ezekiel beyond his own boundaries in that here there is no temple. At least not one built with bricks and mortar. Why? Because the community of people who belong to Him are now His temple. In them His glory dwells, and through them, the text indicates, His glory radiates. It shimmers in splendor and magnificence. It's what makes this bride beautiful. Which tells us something, my friends, of great importance. And that is this, that the indescribable beauty we will possess on that day will not be an intrinsic one that earns us the right to be the bride of Jesus Christ. This beauty here is derived. This beauty here is owing to what God has done for us. That's why we're beautiful. Because of God and what He does and His glory and His presence among us. This, after all, I would remind you, is the Lamb's bride. He has bought her, in the words of the Revelation. He has beautified her. We will be who we will be on that day, totally and completely, because of Him. God will make us into the dazzling jewel John here describes, by granting His own glory to us, by placing His very presence in our midst. Look at the third descriptive phrase, verse 12. The city had a massive, high wall. Now let me ask you, friends, how do you distinguish today's cities, today's great cities, one from another? Well, one of the ways that you can do this is by observing the line of its skyscrapers. You can identify places like Seattle, San Diego, San Francisco, by its unique skyline. In the ancient world, the wall that surrounded a great city is what gave it its distinctive blessing, its distinctive identity. A city was not regarded as a complete city until it had a surrounding wall. But beyond that, my friends, the wall served as a sign of something else. It served as a sign of security, as a sign of safety. But I would remind you, this is not a literal city. Nor is this a literal wall. Rather, the symbol of this great high wall is to suggest that the church will always remain secure in her possession of communion with God. My friends, one of the great benefits of eternal life will be the feeling of absolute security, knowing, reveling in the fact that there will be nothing to threaten or jeopardize the intimacy of your communion with God and His Lamb, Jesus Christ. The fourth descriptive phrase, notice, the city had a massive high wall with 12 gates, having 12 gates. 12 angels were at the gates. On the gates' names were inscribed the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. There were 3 gates on the east, 3 gates on the north, 3 gates on the south, and 3 gates on the west. Now, friends, why are there angels stationed at these gates? Well, it reminds us, doesn't it, of the cherubim guarding the entrance to the Garden of Eden, ensuring that no unworthy person might eat from the tree of life. We get something hinted at very much like this in verse 27. John writes, nothing profane will ever enter it, no one who does what is vile or false. And why 12 gates? 3 on each side of this four-cornered city. Well, many Roman cities during this time had 3 gates providing entrance on one side of its wall. This city, however, provides such access on all 4 sides, implying that it welcomes people from all directions. How does Jesus say it? They will come from east and west, from north and south, and recline at the table in the kingdom of God. All those written in the Lamb's Book of Life, verse 27 tells us. But again, why 12? Why 12 gates? And in keeping with that, my friends, look at the next descriptive phrase, verse 14. The city wall had 12 foundations, and on them were the 12 names of the Lamb's 12 apostles. Now get the imagery in your mind's eye. 3 gates on each side of this four-cornered wall meant that the entire circuit of the wall was divided into 12 great sections. Each of these 12 sections was then supported by a massive foundation stone. But again, I ask you, did you notice the repeated mention of these 12s? 12, 12. The number 12 and its multiples permeate this entire section. Look at it. 12 gates, 12 angels, 12 tribes, 12 foundations, 12 apostles. Down a little bit lower, 12,000 stadia, 144 cubits, 12 stones, 12 pearls. I assure you, my friends, in this book of Revelation, noted for its apocalyptic genre, John's burden here is not mathematical, least is it architectural, it's symbolical. Throughout the Revelation, the number 12 and its multiples are used as a symbol to speak of the people of God. Here in these particular descriptions of the city, the names of the 12 tribes of Israel inscribed on the gates. The names of the 12 apostles inscribed on the foundation stones, indicating what? That this city is nothing less than the full and complete expression of the people of God. The old covenant community, the new covenant community, all comprise this new Jerusalem. That means, friends, people like Noah and Abraham and Moses and Elijah and David and Isaiah and people like Mary and Paul and John and Peter and you. Everyone who has ever belonged to the God who has revealed himself most fully in Jesus Christ will be there. Not one missing. This is the city described. It's the work of God, beautified by the glory of God, secured by the protection of God, distinguished by abundant access to God, populated by the full complement of the people of God. Thirdly, the city measured. The city measured. What we have here, beloved, is a city of ridiculous proportions. Preposterous proportions, if you understand this literally. Verse 15, the one who spoke with me had a gold measuring rod to measure the city, its gates, and its wall. The city is laid out in a square. Literally, it is a four-cornered city. Its length and width are the same. He measured the city with the rod at 12,000 stadia. Now, some of you here this morning may have a Bible translation that converts this into its American equivalent, so that it may say something like this: 1,400 miles. The problem with this is that while it makes the size of this city more understandable to us, it loses the emphasis on the multiple 12. And thus, our ability to see the symbolism in this number is compromised. You lose it. See? You don't think in terms of the symbolism that's going on in this chapter. At that point, the translation harms our ability to understand this. But notice another clue, friends, that indicates its symbolic emphasis. Look, its length, its width, watch now, and height are equal. You know what this means? This city is not just a square, it's a cube. A geometric form in the ancient world that was used as a standard of perfection. So are we to be thinking here about a literal city? 1,400 miles long. 1,400 miles wide. 1,400 miles high. I would remind you, friends, that it is very difficult to breathe on the top of Mount Everest, the tallest point on our planet, which is not quite 6 miles above sea level. This city, if assumed to be literal, is 1,400 miles high. That's the distance from San Francisco to Dallas, to give you some sense of proportion. 1,400 miles long, wide, high. May I suggest something else? Something much more in keeping with the genre of the Revelation. Where in the entire Bible, I ask you, do you find the only other mention of this geometric shape? There is only one other cube in all of the Bible. The most holy place. The Holy of Holies. The location where God placed the greatest and most immediate manifestation of His presence. And by the way, just as a little side note, a cube has how many sides? 12 sides. And here we're told that each side is 12,000 stadia. What's 12 times 12,000? 144,000. The number already used in the Revelation, chapter 7, chapter 14, to speak of the entirety of the people of God. Beloved, I want to tell you the purpose of measuring this city is to display the fullness of God's presence that will forever be with the totality of His people. And notice what John adds to this, verse 17. Then he measured its wall 144 cubits according to human measurement, which the angel used. Now again, friends, this is one of these phrases that help us understand that this is not to be understood literally. All you need to do is a little math to realize how absurd it is to think about this in literal categories. We've got a real problem if it's to be understood literally. 144 cubits, translated into its American equivalent, means about 216 feet. But I ask you now, what is this angel measuring? He says he's measuring the wall. But is he measuring the height of the wall? That would be very strange. A city 1,400 miles high, surrounded by a protective wall that extends up from the ground about 72 yards. It would be hopelessly disproportionate. Well, maybe he's measuring the thickness of the wall. But that just changes disproportion into bad architecture. 72 yards is only a fraction of the width needed for a wall 1,400 miles high. Oh, my friends, don't be silly. What is 144 cubits? 144 is 12 times 12. Yet another measurement that reinforces the emphasis that this city is the place where God's presence exists. This city is a figurative expression of God's presence with His people. The New Jerusalem is a people for a place. And the place is the new heaven and the new earth. And wherever we go, beloved, in the new heaven and the new earth, it will be the Holy of Holies, you see, because the immediate presence of God will be in the very midst of His people. Finally, the city evaluated. We've seen the city identified, described, and measured. Now it's evaluated. And what I mean by that is simply this. A consideration of the materials used to construct this city reveals it to possess a worth and a value that is beyond all powers of comprehension. For example, verse 18. The building material of its wall was jasper. That was mentioned back up in verse 11, remember? Defined up there as a very precious stone. The idea is it's a stone that is extremely expensive. He goes on, and the city itself was pure gold like clear glass. Gold, then as now, is one of the most prized resources known to human beings. A symbol of wealth and affluence. It can shine. It can be highly reflective. But my dear friends, as we presently understand it at this very moment, gold in no way resembles the transparency of glass. In this vision, however, in this consideration of the church's beauty, John shatters the paradigm of our experience. He pushes us beyond the capacities of the first earth so as to convey something of the unimaginable beauty of the bride in the eyes of her husband. Gold was rare. This is gold. Clear glass was extraordinarily rare. This is as clear as glass. And yet, it is both of these things, a gold that is of such a quality that it's altogether transparent. And my friends, what makes this amazing, if you think about it, is that when something is transparent, when you can see the light passing through it, you can easily detect the slightest flaw, the slightest scratch, the slightest imperfection. But here, there's none of that. Because this transparent gold, John tells us, is pure gold. Verse 19. The foundations of the city wall were adorned with every kind of precious stone. The first foundation, jasper. The second, sapphire. The third, chalcedony. The fourth, emerald. The fifth, sardonyx. The sixth, carnelian. The seventh, chrysolite. The eighth, beryl. The ninth, topaz. The tenth, chrysoprase. The 11th, jacinth. The 12th, amethyst. How many jewels? How many? 12. What you may not be mindful of is that these precious jewels are akin to the 12 jewels that were worn on the breastplate of the high priest when he entered into the Holy of Holies, when he entered into the very presence of God. What did those 12 stones represent? On each one was inscribed the names of the tribes of Israel, the covenant people, God's bride. These stones here that adorn the foundation of this city, they are symbols, my friends, of God's people. They are symbols of you. Likened here to precious gemstones to indicate the priceless value of each one to God. Verse 21 says, the 12 gates are 12 pearls. Each individual gate was made of a single pearl. Are these literal pearls? Well, my friends, if the measured wall back in verse 17 is literally 144 cubits high, 72 yards, then we have to think of a pearl the size of which would represent a gate proportional to 72 yards. That's a big pearl. If, however, the wall measured back in verse 17 is 144 cubits thick, and thus the wall of the city 1,400 miles high, for those of you who like to think literally, then we have to think of a pearl here, the size of which must represent a gate proportional to 1,400 miles. Now pay your money and take your choice. In either case, I'd like to see the oysters in which these pearls grew. Oh, don't be silly. He's not talking about literal pearls. He's trying to illustrate something to us, my friends. In the Greco-Roman world, a perfect pearl was worth more than its weight in gold. Jesus spoke of a pearl so valuable that a merchant sold all he possessed in order to buy it. Each of these gates is a single pearl. How could you begin to quantify the worth of this city? What's more, the broad street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. In this city, even the humble pavement underfoot is of incalculable value. But dear friends, I would remind you, John is not talking about the physical components of a coming metropolis. The home of the bride is the new heaven and the new earth. This is not a literal city. These are not literal foundation stones. They are not literal gates. This is not a literal street. Beloved, what you're looking into here is a mirror. You're not just a spectator this morning, you're the spectacle. All of this, you see, reveals the infinite value and worth of the bride. Infinitely valuable to whom? To the one who assigns value. Infinitely valuable and worth, of great worth to God, to the Lamb, to the ones responsible for establishing our worthiness. And this is where we finish. All of this ought to fill you with two overwhelming sensations. On the one hand, my friends, it ought to fill you with a sense of amazement. It ought to fill you with a sense of amazement. Amazement that the church, unworthy as she is, fallen, sullied, flawed, inconsistent, should be raised to this place of honor at the side of her husband, the Lamb. This uncommon union, beloved, ought to fill you with wonder, and that wonder ought to drive you to worship the one who brings it to pass. It ought to fill you with a sense of amazement. And secondly, it ought to fill you with a sense of determination. It ought to fill you with a sense of resolve. It ought to fill you with a sense of renewed commitment and devotion. It ought to fill you with a sense of determination that even now you will love the church and esteem the church and live out your life with the church in a manner that reveals your appreciation for the value of the church to God. With a love and a respect for the church that anticipates her great and glorious destiny. She shares the stage with Jesus Christ. You can't be ambivalent about the church. Not in claim to love her Savior. This is the consummation of the uncommon union. Do you see yourself in the mirror? I hope that you do. I pray that you do. Let's pray together, shall we?